We'll start this afternoon by opening a work session on House Bill 2995. On 2995, Paul Warner from Legislative Revenue Office will help us with that bill.
Mr. Chair, 2995, you had heard earlier and actually had a discussion of a Dash 1 amendments, but now you have from Representative Galizio a Dash 4 amendment that was based on committee discussion on the language and cleaning up that language. It has to do with regulation of the tax refund anticipation loans. And you received quite a bit of testimony on how that process works now and what the intent of the bill was. What the amendment does is clarify some of the language in terms of a facilitator, makes reference to statute with respect to the tax practitioners and tax consultants under 673.640, and it states that a facilitator must have a license in that area in order to be involved in these types of loans. It clarifies what kinds of information the recipient of the loan has to receive by the provider. And then it also, in Section 4, does impose limits on local governments in terms of requirements that they and prevents them from superseding or preempting any rule under 174.116.
Paul, can you give us an update on Senate Bill 968 on the Senate side? Representative Dingfelder has been working to get a refund anticipation loan bill cranked up over there.
Mr. Chair, I don't know the status of that currently. It is not something that has been worked on in the Senate Revenue Committee, but I can track that down for the committee and see where that is.
Yeah, I'm going to guess that it will probably be referred back through or could be referred back through this committee. I just want to make sure that our efforts are coordinated.
Okay.
The chair recognizes Representative Galizio.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So again, just a reminder, I mean, the idea with this bill is that it allows families to make more informed decisions in terms of their finances. And I'm happy to say that got together with folks from H&R Block, HSBC, and also there's been quite a large number of groups, ecumenical ministries, and we put together the Dash 4 amendments, which take care of a lot of concerns that stakeholders had. And I think we now have a bill that has clear disclosure so that people can make informed decisions about whether or not they want a refund anticipation loan is in their best interest. And also, it talks about those who can and cannot do. Paul actually explained it quite well. So I think I'm happy with the way it turned out, and I hope we can go forward.
As you mentioned, Representative Galizio, you brought on board the tax preparers, the facilitators, the banks, and the lending organizations, as well as the tax preparation companies, the large tax preparation companies that are involved in this. Further discussion? Representative Galizio now moves the Dash 4 into House Bill 2995. Is there any discussion? Any objection to the motion to move Dash 4 amendments into House Bill 2995? Seeing and hearing none, so ordered. Representative Esquivel is excused for the moment. He'll be back when he's done testifying. Colleagues, this is a bill that's brought forward by both Representatives Esquivel and Galizio, we appreciate the work that you've done on it. Further discussion of the of House Bill 2995, as it's been amended with the Dash 4 amendment, dated 5/11.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative
Wilkins. Since they're both split, I move that House Bill 2995, as amended, be moved to the House floor with a due pass.
You've heard the motion. Any discussion to the motion? The motion is that House Bill 2995 with Dash 4 be moved to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Berger?
Only to say thanks to the folks who worked it and made it go. That's a nice list of folks who worked it.
I think we've had even Representative Dingfelder came forward and testified on behalf of it, and I've counted on Representative Galizio to make sure that because I just don't want to move differently than one of our House leaders as well. So with that, the motion is to move 2995 with the -4 amendment to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection to that motion? Hearing and seeing none, and recognizing Representative Esquivel is excused, the motion passes. I'll assign that to Representatives Esquivel and Galizio to carry it at your common bill.
Thank you
very much. We will close the work session on House Bill 2995. Good work. Thank you very much, fellows. Thank you, Paul. Let's see. Paul, we have, we've got folks here on other bills, so let's go back and start back up at the head of the list.
Okay.
We'll open a work session on House Bill 2191. This bill comes to us, this bill creates a labor rebate for costs incurred by persons engaged in film production in Oregon. If costs exceed the threshold level, it provides opportunity for those folks, or an incentive for those folks, to bring their businesses to Oregon. Elizabeth?
Chairman Butler and committee members, we've heard this bill twice before, but basically, to recap it, again, it's a labor rebate for people who invest $1 million or more in actual expenses on film, television shows, or commercial productions in Oregon. It details that the Oregon Film and Video Office will pay a rebate to a taxpayer who has been certified by the office and has made these special withholding payments and has verifiable actual production expenses to support a claim for the labor rebate. It specifies that the labor rebate will equal the amount that is withheld and deposited into a Greenlight Oregon Labor Rebate Fund. So this is the one where it's creating a special withholding rate. And then that amount of withholdings on the employees who are employed by the person who has invested more than $1 million in the fund or in expenditures on film or television shows will then be put into this fund to then pay a labor rebate. It outlines the requirements for qualifying film productions. It allows the Office of Film and Video to deduct the amount of labor rebate costs incurred in order to verify the actual film production expenses, as well as the cost of an accountant to review or audit the accounts. Then it provides the Office of Film and Video rulemaking authority and the ability to pay these rebate checks to their eligible taxpayers. If a taxpayer does not have verifiable actual film production expenses in excess of $1 million, then the office may not pay a labor rebate, and the monies in the Greenlight Oregon Labor Rebate Fund may be used for other purposes designated by the Office of Film and Video. It sunsets its labor rebate on January 1st, 2012. It establishes the Greenlight Oregon Labor Rebate Fund in the state treasury. Interest earned in this fund then is continuously appropriated to Economic Community Development Department for the purpose of transferring funds requested by the Office of Film and Video for the purposes of making these labor rebates. It specifies then in the bill a withholding rate of 6.2% of the compensation paid for employees who are engaged in this film production until January 1st, 2007. Then in tax years 2007 and beyond, the Department of Revenue may prescribe by rule a different withholding rate for qualified employers, and this rate will supersede the 6.2% rate that's specified in statute. It requires a person who has this special withholding rate to file a report with the Oregon Film and Video Office, and it lists the amount of money that has been compensated to each person, each one of the employees, and the names, social security numbers of those employees, and the total amount that would be withheld from each employee. It authorizes the Department of Revenue to deposit monies into a suspense account that are withheld and paid to the department, and that amount equals the amount reported to the Department of Oregon Film and Video. So basically, the Department of Revenue has to go in and check and make sure that these people actually paid in that amount in W-2s that is listed in what is reported to the Office of Film and Video. Allows the Department of Revenue up to 0.5% of the amount deposited in the suspense account to cover their administrative costs. It excludes the labor rebate from Oregon taxable income for the person who's receiving that labor rebate, and it's effective 90 days after the end of session. So, again, there is a revenue loss in personal income taxes because you're taking withholdings of personal income taxes and you're depositing them and funneling them to this Green Light Oregon Labor Rebate Fund. So it's a reduction in general fund revenue and then an increase in this labor rebate fund account. These estimates are based on just assumptions that were made as far as the number of film productions, assuming two full feature film productions, 6 independent films, 2 television movies, and 10 commercials per biennium. If all of these are not produced, then that loss in general fund will be smaller. But obviously, if there's more, then the revenue loss would be bigger. But basically, this is also assuming that you would keep at that 6.2% withholding rate because, again, the Department of Revenue can decide by rule in the outer years what is that withholding rate, and that could obviously affect your general fund revenue loss.
Thank you.
And you do have the dash, we have a dash A3, A4, and A5. I've just spoken to all three of those. You would need all of those in order to
The A5. I've got A3 and A4, and I don't have the current SMS. I've asked for a current SMS.
A5 A5 was at the last meeting, and that was when I think Representative Berger. Yeah, if you don't, does everyone have the last SMS? Because it does say A3, A4, and A5, what each one does. A3 is the one requiring the person who has a special withholding rate to have the filing requirement with the Oregon Film and Video. This was really done in order to reduce the fiscal impact for the Department of Revenue. So it takes some of the responsibilities off the Department of Revenue and puts it on the Oregon Film and Video Office to acquire the names, Social Security numbers of the employees. Just requires the Department of Revenue to still verify that these folks had paid taxes and whatnot. A4 then specifies that special withholding rate at 6.2% because in the bill it's a blank. So this sets it at 6.2%, which again, as we discussed in prior meetings, this is just an average. It certainly is not going to represent each and every employee's withholding rate they would have had under personal income taxes. There's just no way to do that unless you have the actual withholding tables be the basis on which you're deciding a withholding rate. But since you're coming up with some average here, then this is just an average of the with the amount of the actual we saw from surveys of the film industry and how much they had in wages. So that's basically a 6.2 is an average for that particular industry. And then the A5 is specifying because in the original bill we had the Oregon Office of Film and Video be the agency that was going to actually be given the money from the Green Light Oregon Labor Rebate Fund in the state treasury, but you needed to have a state agency be the one who has continuously appropriated that money. That was something that fiscal pointed out as well as treasury. So that's what the A5 does, is it allows the Economic Community Development Department to have those funds continuously appropriated to them, and then they will give it to the Office of Film and Video.
Representative Riley, you served on the committee that this bill was referring to revenue. Your analysis here today.
This is a good bill. I believe that I know that we are losing film production to other states and to Canada because they're able to offer more incentives than we have been in the past. This won't equal some of those, but the film folks think that this will be sufficient to help bring some back in. It does have a revenue impact on revenue that we won't get if we don't pass it.
I'm following that.
Okay. So really, it's bringing business to Oregon, and that brings revenue. And if we don't pull out the welcome mat and dust it off from time to time, then
we're losing the film business in the state because of other states' incentives. Yes, sir.
You bet. Thank you very much. Further discussion of the amendments. Now, we have not adopted either the A3, A4, or A5 amendments, and we'll need to adopt those one at a time if it's the committee's wish to proceed. Representative Riley moves the A3 amendments to House Bill 2191. Is there any discussion? Further discussion on the amendment A3? Hearing and seeing none, is there any objection? Any objection to adding the A3 amendments to 2191? Hearing no objection and seeing no objection, and we have a full committee. Let's see, Representative Olson has stepped out for a moment and can be excused. With that, we have full committee. We will go ahead and order the A3 adopted to 2191. Representative Riley now moves the A4 to House Bill 2191. The motion is to move the A4 amendments as discussed in the SMS. Any discussion? Any objection to moving the A4? Hearing and seeing none, and excusing Representative Olson, so ordered. Representative Berger now moves the A5, to which we have received today in the packet, to House Bill 2191. Any discussion on the A5? Any objection to moving the A5 amendments? Hearing and seeing none, and excusing Representative Olson, so ordered. Representative Berger now moves 2191 with the as amended, as discussed here today, to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation.
To
your motion.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm a big, as I indicated before, fan of film, and we have in the past had a number of films produced here in Oregon, but we have lost, I believe, sort of our market edge. We still have the beautiful scenery, we still have the good crews, but we're going to lose them if we don't get films, TV shows, these things back. This is a step in the right direction. I really appreciate the committee's looking at this in a good way, and the good work of all the folks who got the film and video agency has been sort of something a little different, not our usual state model for things, so getting economic development in here is a good piece because that's really what we're talking about here. I really like this bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Riley.
If I could add one point, Mr. Chair. Film shot in Oregon also has a further benefit in that it's a good draw. People see Oregon all over the country and all over the nation in film and then come here and spend their money here. And so I think, you know, this is a very good bill.
This is more than just a renewable resource then, isn't it? Great. Further discussion. The motion is to pass House Bill 2191 as amended to the floor of the House with due pass recommendation. Any objection to that motion? Hearing and seeing none, and excusing Representative Olson on other House business, the motion passes. Representative Berger, will you carry that to the floor, please?
I'd be happy to.
Thank you very much.
We will, Representative Berger.
We will close, paint your wagon. We will close the work session on 2191. We'll open the work session on House Bill 2340. Colleagues, 2340, authorize the Board of our Rural Fire Protection District to create fees for services provided by the district. We've had a couple of hearings on this, and the last time we met, we were discussing the kinds of fees and the amounts of fees, and I think we've talked about the various EM fees and fire, or first response, ambulance transport, fire suppression inspections and those kinds of things. So, Mary.
Well, as you said, this bill has been before you twice, and during the last previous work public hearing, I believe a representative of the rural fire districts indicated that the intent of the bill is to provide rural fire districts with the same authority that urban fire districts have with respect to charging fees or providing certain services. And some examples, at the request of the committee, initially you wanted some more information about prices and whether it was a incremental cost or full cost, and you had a response to that at the last hearing. Some examples were given for the services, the types of services that would be rendered, and the fees that would be charged for the recovery, cost recovery associated with these services. At present, we have about 250, I believe, rural fire districts in Oregon, and some of them are currently providing these additional special services at their own expense within their current budget. Others are not, or may not be able to afford to do it, there's just a question here about the intent of current law, and they'd like clarification, basically.
Okay. Further discussion? I show no amendments.
No.
Further discussion by the committee members on the proposal to pass 2340 today? Representative Bloomquist.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2340 be moved to the floor to do pass.
The motion is to pass House Bill 2340 to the House of the Floor of Representatives with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing no objection, and excusing Representative Olson for other House business, we'll pass House Bill 2340. Motion passes 2340 to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation. Representative Boquist, that was your motion. You wanted the
Mr. Chair, I would. I noticed this is a special request from Representative Kremel. I would be happy to carry it unless he wants to.
Yeah, he was in on it. Let's assign Representative Kremel, and then if he has any difficulties, so let's assign Representative Kremel for that bill. And I think that probably is that fine. Okay. Yeah, we got the fire district on saying fine. Okay. So Representative Kremel. Unless we've got a firefighter on the floor, let's see, that'd be Representative Krupp. They're shaking their head wildly yes on that. Let's get to, as long as he doesn't wear his firefighting uniform that day, let's assign that to Representative Krupp. Thank you. Thank you, Mary. we'll close the work session on House Bill 2340. Elizabeth? Okay. We'll open the work session on House Bill 2787. This bill expands the rural health care tax credit to include emergency medical technician services performed in rural areas. And Representative Boquist, you've been working on this. There are some amendments. Colleagues, we're going to work on this bill today, but I don't know that we're going to be able to accomplish it. But I do want this to be done in some degree of increments, as long as we have the blessing of leadership in the House to try and get this worked and out. So I think we have -3 amendments on rural medical issues. So
Chairman Butler, sorry. The documentation you have says -3, but it's really -4 that you're getting.
Okay.
So that's what your SMS and your staff measures, and your revenue impact is on the -4. I just got my numbers screwed up before I printed these out.
Okay.
Do you want me to?
2787.
Yeah, 2787.
And the SMS should show -4.
-4. Everything should be referring to -4. That's
okay. Go ahead, Elizabeth, please.
Yeah. So basically with the -4, originally the bill was just dealing with EMTs, and we'd gotten some amendments dealing with pharmacists and psychologists. But now we've kind of taken and added some other issues that were brought up in the last meeting dealing with the rural medical provider tax credit. So we have a variety of changes in here, and I'll just start going through them. But basically, we're first defining in statute
Frontier County and rural practice, which then is going to apply just only to the rural medical provider tax credit. And what it's doing then is expanding the current law definition for Frontier to counties which have a population density of 19 square miles or less. And so under current law, it's only 6 people per square mile or less. And so this will this adds in an additional 6 counties. If you look down here at the bottom of, you know, we're basically adding in Crook, Wasco, Jefferson, Klamath, Union, and Curry. You have 10 counties already that are considered frontier. That's Wheeler, Harney, Lake, Wallowa, Gillam, Sherman, Grant, Malheur, Baker, and Morrow. So those are, so you're expanding the definition of frontier, and then what you're doing is doing the opposite with rural. You're making rural, restricting that. And under current law, rural means 10 miles or more from a city with a population of 30,000 or more. This expands it and says you have to be 25 miles from a city with a population of 30,000 or more. So this is then going to be adding in additional, excluding certain cities that will not qualify then if a medical provider is providing services in that rural town. So you have an additional 60 towns that will then not qualify as rural under the 25-mile rule that is then established here for the definition of rural practice. Then it's creating a two-tier rural medical tax credit. So it's specifying that taxpayers who have medical practice in a frontier county, again, the larger definition of frontier, are allowed a maximum credit up to $7,500 in tax year 2006 and up to $10,000 beginning tax year 2007 and beyond. So then you're giving a larger benefit, a larger credit to the more rural counties, the frontier counties. Then it is retaining that $5,000 limit on the tax credit for taxpayers who have their rural medical practice in non-frontier counties. And again, the smaller definition of rural is what is going to be applied there. It phases, and then another important change that is made here, besides the definition of rural and frontier and the credit being two-tiered now, you also are going to phase out this credit for high-income Oregonians. And so that was something that was discussed in the last meeting also. So this means tests it, and it phases it out beginning with income above $200,000. It does it in steps. So $200,000 to $210,000, get 80% of the credit. $210,000 to $220,000, get 60% of it. $220,000 to $230,000, get 20% of it, and then above 240, you're phased out as far as you don't get the rural medical provider tax credit.
For the purposes of the bill, the income here means adjusted gross income.
Adjusted gross income, and it is for both joint and single the same.
Okay.
So it's just a tax return. Then we've got the issue then again of who is going to qualify. So it adds psychologists who have their medical practice in frontier counties. So you have psychologists added, but they have to be in frontier county, and you've got pharmacists that are added that also have to be in frontier county. And then with the pharmacists, it also adds in that provision about how you can't be a chain pharmacy or anything, you know, the 5 or more common ownership. But it also caps the tax credit for pharmacists at $5,000. It doesn't, even though they have to be in the frontier counties, they would be capped at $5,000. It adds then also EMTs, but volunteer EMTs. So they have to have, and the way it came out of council is that the EMT's volunteer service has to at least be 20% of their total emergency medical technical technician services. So basically they've got to be spending at least 20% of their time out there in the frontier counties providing these medical services. So that was some kind of a test to make sure that just wasn't somebody who went out for a weekend and, you know, did service and then got a credit.
But Elizabeth, based upon this, This is 20% of their total emergency medical technician services as a volunteer in Frontier County. So if you get somebody who's running a service station, and they've got to close the service station up and go on medical runs totally voluntarily, then they would qualify for the credit, even though they don't spend 20% of their total time in volunteer. 100% of their time that they spend as a medical emergency medical technician is volunteer.
Okay, so you mean is
they work 95% of their time in their service station. When they close the service station down to go make a medical call, take somebody to the hospital, or to revive someone in an accident, then they would still qualify.
Well, it seems like the 20% here, let me look at it again.
Because the SMS says 20% of their total emergency medical technician services as a volunteer. That would be 100% of that time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, it's on page 5 and it's line 15, 16. The individual provides volunteer emergency medical technical services in a rural area that comprise at least 20% of the total emergency medical technical services provided by that individual in the tax
right.
year.
Okay. And the amount of the credit is?
The amount of the credit is $250, so it is sizably less than the $5,000 for the non-frontier counties or the $10,000 for the frontier counties. It applies to tax credit certifications made by the Office of Rural Health beginning on or after January 1st, 2006. Then it allows the Office of Rural Health to have rulemaking authority to establish that criteria for certifying these new individuals as eligible for this tax credit. So as far as the revenue impact, initially it's actually positive, and the reason why that is just because you have these means testing and the definition of rural, which is excluding individuals as well. Those two are greater than the reduction that you're going to see from going and increasing that credit amount to $7,500 for the frontier counties, and then you're adding again the psychologists, pharmacists, and EMTs. As far as the number of people that you're adding, when you're adding those three groups, the Office of Rural Health, had only really limited information on these different occupations at this time. So they identified in the larger definition of frontier 19 psychologists, 171 pharmacists, and 774 EMTs. Now, these 774 EMTs are both paid and volunteer. So they just couldn't separate them out at this point.
But if they can adequately establish that 20% of the total emergency medical technician service is as a volunteer as opposed to being paid,
right.
then they would be entitled to a credit of up to $250 in those rural, frontier and rural.
So that was another point that the Office of Rural Health brought up, was that many of these EMTs may be both paid and volunteer, so that's why we were trying to kind of get at some kind of a threshold there of the amount of volunteer time they put in. Then with the psychologists, say like they have their work address, which is good, but with the pharmacist, it's just their home address. But you'll notice the way the bill is written, the pharmacy itself has to be in that rural area. So we don't really have data on the pharmacy itself, but you would assume that if their home address within of the pharmacist within that frontier county, then you would assume their pharmacy is not far away.
And again, that doesn't apply to chain pharmacies or five
right.
or more.
That's right. Those kind of connections are not real clean, but it's as good as we can get for data at this point. So as far as the revenue loss, again, the largest components really are the means testing above 200,000, and then the definition of rural. Those provide the two largest positives, and then the increase in the tax credit to the frontier counties medical providers is the largest negative, and then the second largest there is the pharmacists, because you just have such a larger number of pharmacists, 171 there. And so the frontier, even though the EMTs have quite a few people, you've got a really small credit there compared to the rest of them, so that impact is not as large. So out in the in 0507 by any means, you have an increase of 455,759, but by the 2007-09 biennium, you have a reduction of 148,593, and by the 2009-11 biennium, a reduction of $239,493. And this would be reductions in the future bienniums as well.
Okay, Representative Boquist, you've done the yeoman's work on this. The reason for the means testing?
Mr. Chairman, the reason for the means testing is, if you recall in the previous hearing when we looked at the AGI by sector, we were giving tax credits to individuals with AGIs in excess of $1 million. And in the upper tier, there was a range of between $400,000 and some odd to $1 million. And in identifying the income bracket, the average income in the state, we came up with, you know, it's somewhere between, depending on who does the math, $150,000 to $200,000. Now, keep in mind that even though $200,000 is, as you see, that Ms. Beth, who has done most of the yeoman's work of about 10 different models to combine 4 different bills, well, it says above $200,000. It actually doesn't phase out until $240,000. So $200,000 is actually the threshold, and it starts down to $240,000. The other thing to keep in mind in the means testing when you're addressing that issue is it retains in current law that if there are two providers, that both of them qualify for the tax credit, and we did not touch that. So hypothetically, if you had one spouse who was a doctor, and they were eligible initially for the $7,500 credit, and the second spouse was a pharmacist, that they would have a combined credit of the $7,500 and the $5,000. And the means testing that we use to identify the $5,000 tax credit, which is really in the pharmacist's area, because it is really a means, is several members of the committee, if you recall, brought up the issue of pharmacy may not be the primary course of business. It may, in fact, be a pharmacy, and as my district that we talk to, and multiple people, I have one pharmacy that is the liquor store, it's part of the hardware store, and it's a part of just about everything else down the line. And so we tried to mesh that together. And mind you, again, Mr. Chair, you've got to keep in mind that we were dealing the EMT issue, the pharmacist issue, the psychologist issue, and the expansion issue of the tax credit itself. And if you'd like, I can go down through the other items, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I would like to just have you touch on the $250 credit for the EMTs for their voluntary work.
Okay. In the discussion, Mr. Chair, we had, you recall that we had another House bill some weeks ago, I don't remember when, it was blurry way back when we addressed the issue of above-the-line expensing with EMTs. And, of course, that was going into an arena we'd never really ventured into before. And in identifying, frankly, and up front, we started modeling and found out that we may, in fact, be able to afford, you know, something towards this worthy cause. And so to reach the $250 tax credit amount, what we did is we looked from the old bill what those expenses would have been that we were talking about and tried to convert those taxes, those above-the-line expenses, into a tax credit so that we could, in fact, use the language of the one bill, you know, or merging gut and stuff, and whatever we call it. That's where the $250 number came from.
Okay. Questions? Did you want to go through that? Let's go ahead and take some questions first. Representative Hass is recognized.
Thank you. As maybe you, Mr. Chair, or Elizabeth, or Representative Boquist, I understand adding psychologists and pharmacists, the means testing. What is the public policy reason for expanding the definition to serve more people, expanding the number of frontier counties? I'm not saying I oppose it,
right.
I just want to know why.
The rationale we looked at the frontier counties, first of all, frontier counties don't exist technically. It's based on a population density issue. One of the issues that we looked at was the shortfalls in medical services in counties. And quite frankly, one of the counties we looked at in the overall rural area, and if you remember, we got the picture of this before, is that we looked at, for example, the rural issues in Umatilla County. We know from Veterans Committee and other committees that we're short of doctors and stuff out there. So what we tried to do is look at expanding those rural areas that we could get access to. Frankly, we couldn't get to Umatilla County because Douglas County was in the way. Because once you went into Douglas County, it mushroomed. Douglas is in a different category. The other thing that we looked at, I wonder, Shirley, exactly what you're talking about, rural counties, is that we started looking at the mileage. Because what we found is, of course, you have some people that are getting AGI of $1 million, and they're practicing 10 miles, you know, from a metropolitan area. But yet, if you go down to some counties, you'll have rural areas like Alsea or down in Lane County in the coast and other places that we didn't want to exclude. And so, frankly, we just started doing models back and forth to identify it. Because, again, the rural health initiative is to get doctors and, you know, services into those rural areas. And that's kind of the logic. And if you have a better logic, I'm all ears after trying to do four bills in the
Is that sufficient explanation? Representative Galizio is recognized.
Okay.
Further discussion. Representative, did you want to take us?
Mr. Chair, I would, because I'm looking for some comments here, because this is our, frankly, our first stab at trying to merge four bills together. And I'm looking for some input of the committee of, you know, are we going in the right direction? Do we need to look at something different? The first area I explained before is how we moved from the 10 miles to the 25 miles. Mm-hmm. And when we started modeling it, we found if you got beyond 25 miles, then we had small rural communities that would be negatively impacted that we needed to continue to address. And, of course, then we started looking initially, you know, there was the issue of going to a $10,000 credit, and the question is you can't get there quickly without a serious negative impact on the revenue side, and at what point could we phase in? And we actually kind of came to that conclusion not more than about 2 hours ago. So I think it's a yeoman's effort from Liz Best position to actually have something to present to us at this point. The other thing is that if you notice that $7,500, you know, phases in now and then phases to $10,000, which was what one of the bills originally did out in the future, and it does have a revenue impact. The reason, again, when I talked about the income level of $200,000, which actually phases out at $240,000, I talked briefly about that before, and we'd actually modeled a lower number and we modeled a higher number to see how they came out. And, you know, one of the issues you come up in the very rural areas is you're balancing how much does the provider get paid versus, and you need to bring them in versus, you know, what is the median income in those areas. And even at this point, you know, we're in some areas where, you know, we're 10 times the median income. What a doctor or a provider would make is 10 times what the median is kind of for the local area. The one thing you notice is, again, I talked about we capped the pharmacy at $5,000 based on simply the fact that it was a joint business, and the business would have other items besides pharmacies. EMTs, we talked about. The one area that remains a little bit blurry, and I don't have an answer for it, I need to bring the committee's attention, is that when we did identify that we had the potential to do tax credits within our capacity and the revenues available, is the certification that the Office of Rural Health would have to go through. How do you determine which of the EMTs are certified? Part of the discussion on that came down of even the Department of Revenue saying, well, we could make it simpler, but again, we're trying to target rural areas and we want to be able to track it. And that means that we need the Office of Rural Health to tell us how many EMTs are in each of these locations so that we find out whether this targeted tax credit is really working. And whether it's going to be a benefit to it. And I think it's, I don't know what the fiscal on that is, and I'm not sure if Office of Rural Health has been able to identify that at this point. Maybe it is definite.
They'll talk to it, I think.
Okay. Yeah. Representative, just one comment on that with regard to the EMTs was that my recollection was that with relicensure, transportation to various continuing education meetings, costs, out-of-pocket costs for both equipment as well as some of the other kinds of things that these folks are incurring, out-of-pocket to be volunteers. I think we came up with a figure between 2,000 and 3,000, and the more rural they became, the more that number became, because sometimes the travel, the weekly travel for meetings, the continuing education costs, those kinds of things are much more the further rural you become. And I think at $3,000 times 8% was $240, so you came up with a $250 credit to compensate those that provide 20% or more of their time, of the EMTs that volunteer their time.
And further to that, Mr. Chair, one of the challenges of looking at the other side, the bill we had 3 or 4 weeks ago, is if you were doing above-the-line expenses, is not only would you be adding an expense line, but then you'd have a mileage line too, which is a separate calculation, as you know, under the federal, and when you apply that. So it become much more complex. So the more rural the area, actually the higher expense you're going to have due to the mileage.
Would this, just by way of discussion on that point, would this preclude them from then, if they do have thousands of dollars worth of continuing education expense, which I assume would be an itemized deduction, would that preclude them from using that as a Schedule A itemized subject to the 2%?
Mr. Chair, you're the CPA, but I think that as a volunteer, you'd be hard-pressed to do that unless you were working for a nonprofit.
Why don't we get that on the record? Because I think that our intention here is that if they want to itemize their deductions and they do in fact have itemized deductions in excess of the 2% of adjusted gross income, that they may well be able to have a tax credit as well as the itemized deduction if they're going through that. Mm-hmm. And I think that benefits the folks that are probably homeowners more stable in those communities as well. Right. Elizabeth, did you?
Yeah, well, Chairman Butler, there's nothing in the bill that says you cannot take both the tax credit and the deductions. So.
Okay. Representative Guizio.
Not that consistency is ever really that important. I'm just curious about... do we define frontier and rural in different ways all over the place in statute and state of Oregon? Is that an accurate statement?
Chairman Butler and Representative Galizio, it was something I talked with the Office of Rural Health about because I wanted to make sure that we weren't causing them havoc with putting those definitions in. But currently, that's another reason why I don't know if you noticed in the bill, but council also put in here that rural critical access hospital, they put that definition in there, and the type A hospital and type B, just because those are things that were already defined in statute, and they just wanted to put it all in one place so it was clear. But no, the Office of Rural Health is only going to use this definition like a frontier county for this medical provider tax credit. It's not going to constrain them. They can use that they were saying how the reason why they had the original definition for frontier county being six people per square mile was because that was the federal definition. So they were following federal law at that point. So they can still, in their own rules, define frontier county for other reasons different than this.
Can I have a response? Yes, please follow up.
One more question. So and I know you've got to do a lot of balancing here. So my understanding is the original credit was 1989 was when it first.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about, I think, 16 years ago. So the choice was we're going to expand the health care providers, the groups of health care providers that get it, and we're going to do that at the expense of increasing that for other folks. Is that kind of what the choice you made there?
Or
keeping it the same?
And keeping them in more of the rural area. They're only allowed in the frontier areas, the new people. And yes, we have broadened the definition of frontier, but at the same time, you're only allowing the new people in those frontier areas.
And will we see a list of the 60 places?
I can sure give you that. Sure. Yeah, I have that.
Thank you.
Well, there's 16 counties that are rural now, or that are frontier counties with this expanded definition.
Yeah, and so you've got that listed in your SMS as far as the counties that are coming in.
You've got a list of the cities?
I've got a list of the cities. I just didn't write it in your SMS.
Okay, all right. Maybe that'd be an excellent handout.
Sure.
And I think that Representative Boquist, that very detailed map of the rural versus frontier I think it's an excellent. I think there's two iterations of that map that show both that identify crosshatch the frontier counties that we have in the state. In the past we've used a federal definition, and that's six people per square mile.
Right, per frontier.
Per frontier. Okay, I looked it up on the internet the other day, and it was 5.5 on an old definition from 1890, 5.5 people. So, for the record, you could triple the people in my square miles, and we still wouldn't meet the 1890 definition of frontier county. So, pretty Yeah, Representative.
Mr. Chair, follow up. I mean, I'm hopeful that next, as I say, we just kind of came to this result in the last couple of hours, is that, you know, by our next meeting or before then, we'll be able to get a copy of a map that outlines what we're defining and the cities as Representative Galizio said. And even after the testimony, I appreciate any members that have, that think we ought to go up or down or any place on any of the numbers, to let me know, because I just tried to pick the balance of four bills and put it together in a package at the starting point.
Representative Hess?
Thank you. I was just wondering about going from 6 to 19 people. Why 19? Why 6? Why not leave it at 6? Why go to 19? Why not 15? Why not 29?
Again, it comes back to the issue. What we're trying to address is that we know from other activities in the legislature that we have some rural counties based on the fact that shortfalls in medical, specifically Umatilla and Klamath counties. And frankly, we were trying to get to that point. We were trying to expand enough to those areas where we know we're short of providers and a whole host of areas, that we're seeing critical mental health needs. We're going to see an expansion of those mental health needs with the return of the 116th, you know, Cavalry National Guard coming back. And we were trying to expand it within our means to get as many counties that had problems into that category. And where we ran a stumbling block was Douglas County. So we went up to the 19, you know, people, and unfortunately, I didn't do the geography of the state of Oregon. When you go to Douglas County, Douglas is in front of Umatilla, and Douglas County right now would have almost doubled the total number of providers in the model. And so we couldn't get there geographically. And under the constitutional law, you can't define them as frontier. We can't pick counties. It has to be based on a population density issue. And that's why we got to where we are. We actually wanted to be one step farther, and it didn't happen.
And the issue with both Umatilla and Klamath is that those are both heavy military because of the military base in Klamath Falls and the Army Depot in Umatilla.
And more to that, what the problem is they are the two, and you know, no disrespect to those counties or cities, but those are the two areas where we cannot find providers to provide assistance to veterans and to military personnel, so on and so forth. And the committee, I think all the members of the committee, the Veterans Committee, sent a letter to our good senator from Pendleton, our United States senator, and asked him to intervene locally to try and help us resolve this crisis that's there. On the flip side of the coin is because of the population densities in Klamath Falls and in Klamath County, is they fell under the number quite a way, several counties under the number. And that's literally how we got to where we were. We tried to expand it to cover as many territories. Same thing with the 25-mile rule, is we still wanted to make sure we hit those rural coastal communities, we hit those fringe communities out on the edge, like maybe Mill City and Marion County. And, you know, if you go out in Washington County and push out towards places like Vernonia and stuff like that, we want to make sure we've got all the rural areas, as many rural areas as possible.
So that the credit would expand as far as you could.
Right.
Further questions? Was that responsive, Representative?
Yes, it was.
Okay. Further questions? Representative Boquist, Elizabeth, thank you very much. And we want to express gratitude also to Legislative Council. Colleagues, it's my proposal that we not amend and append the -4s at this time until we've had a further opportunity to take a look at those and then get the handouts that you've had the benefit of, and particularly the maps, so that we can kind of see what the state looks like with the 25-mile around those rural towns and so forth. Further discussion on House Bill 2787. Again, thank you for the good work, and we appreciate that. We'll bring back, depending upon the time, we'll bring back 2787, but I would like to have all of us have the benefit of the handouts and updates, if you would, please. Okay. With that, colleagues, if there's no further discussion on 2787 or the amendment thereto, we'll close the work session on 2787.
How to get a starting point.
Let's see. We'll open the work session on 2650, House Bill 2659. And we've got some -3 and -4.
-3 and -4.
All right, -3 and -4. Okay. 2659 is the restates that refund of property tax is required when refund is ordered or stipulated. Okay. Mary?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2659 retains the six-year limit for filing a claim for property tax refund if you would like it processed. So from the time that you actually have a request in for a refund, you can do that within 6 years of the time that you overpaid the tax. If you file after that period under current law, you would not be eligible for a tax refund. If you file within the six-year time limit and you're not paid that refund, you're eligible for processing because you filed it on time, but you haven't been paid. And the way to handle under current law, you could process that, but this bill will simplify the process greatly. Okay. It will, for example, allow you to process the claim file it within that six-year period, and you can obtain qualification and be paid your refund if the county governing authority approves it. And in under the current bill, you would only need an order from the Department of Revenue, the tax court, or the Supreme Court, and it would constitute a final determination of the order that's not subject to appeal. In addition, a county assessor or a tax collector could issue a written stipulation that would constitute a final determination of the matter. The House Bill also applies to tax years imposed beginning on or after July 1, 1991, that are subject to appeal, including a supervisory appeal under a particular statute for which a final determination or stipulated judgment had not been issued prior to 2004. The background on this material clearly shows you that there's a sort of a double process that goes on. If you file your claim within the six-year period and it's not been paid within that period, you may still be awarded a refund if you go through the process that I suggested above. However, those processes only become material that's given to the county the county governing authority. The county governing authority ultimately has the final decision. So it's a second step. All of the information, for example, from the Supreme Court, the tax court, that goes would go to the governing authority to make the decision at its discretion about whether or not that tax should be paid. So the House bill shortens up, abbreviates the process, simplifies it, if you will, but it takes certain ultimate authority, discretionary authority, away from the county governing authority. Okay. According to the Department of Revenue, there are about 505 outstanding refund claims under appeal that are 6 or more years beyond the tax years for which the claims were filed. All of the outstanding claims pertain to property that is described as low-income housing. Some of the counties have exercised their authority to issue refunds on the claims that are 6 or more years old, and if other counties decided to follow suit, then the impact of this bill would be negligible. Okay. This bill has a -3 and a -4 amendment. The -3 amendment will delete the last line of the first paragraph that you have in the original amendment. And that line is the line that stipulates that a county tax assessor may issue a written stipulation that constitutes a final determination of the matter. That's the only thing that comes out of the House bill that is in the -3 amendment. The -4 amendment deletes the second paragraph that says that it applies to certain tax years after 1991. Instead, the -4 amendment will basically stipulate that the bill, the -4, will apply to the final non-appealable decisions of the Oregon Department of Revenue, the Oregon Tax Court, or the Oregon Supreme Court, rendered after May 5, 2005.
That are not subject to appeal. Where did the -4 amendment come from?
The dash 3 and the dash 4 amendment were submitted by the chamber. Let me check this out. I have it in front of me.
Joe, I should have, you brought me in the tree. This has been my pleasure to work this bill, probably more than any bill that I've ever worked in my entire life.
I can see it's been your pleasure.
And the last time we met on this, I received these dash 3, which are now called the dash 2, which are now called, and I just got a draft of them. Joe, do you want to come up and just tell me where this came from, please? I just need to know. Yeah, that's fine. Joe, you had previously given me a what we'd call dash 2 and had expressed to me that we had most everyone on board. And that last line, it says page 3, delete line 13 of the matter that is not subject to appeal.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if I may, we may also want to get...
For the record, Joe.
For the record, Joe Schweinhart from Associated Oregon Industries. At your request, Mr. Chairman, we brought the parties together. If we may get Gil Rydell up here, if he's out
Gil,
there.
Please.
From the counties and have him come up.
You bet.
We were talking dash 2s when we were talking to you, and we all got together and worked this thing out, and
Excellent.
We came up with a dash 3, which kind of set everybody's mind at ease, I think, for where we came with an agreement.
So what is now dash 3, the official record, it modifies that ever so slightly. What we were working on was a dash 2.
Right.
To further clarify what it is. And then there's also now a dash 4. Where did we get dash 4? Where did that come from? I didn't show it from...
Mr. Chair, you had sent that as your dash 3, but it was unofficial.
Right, yeah,
there was a rewrite of one of them.
Okay.
And so instead of a dash 2, you have a dash 4.
Became a
four.
Dash 3, and then I've got
a dash 3
four.
Became a dash 4.
Okay. And tell me what the dash 4 is. Chris, are you...
Yeah. Chairman Butler, members of the committee, my name is Chris Robinson. I'm here on behalf of Metro Multifamily Housing. The purpose of the dash 4 amendment is to address some concerns that AOC had about this bill. And so it was some compromise language that we worked out to make clear that it would apply to adjudications after May 5, 2005, which was the day we met. And so going forward, if their taxpayer has a longstanding tax appeal and obtains a decision in their favor, this bill makes it very clear that they are entitled to a refund without regard to the six-year limitation and without the requirement of the written claim for refund.
Okay. And Gil, you have some talking points on 2659, and you show the dash 2 and dash 3. Should that be dash 3 and dash 4?
Well, Mr. Chairman, he hasn't had a chance today. We're just hot off the press when they got here.
Okay. They are dated today, so...
Mr. Chairman, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties, they look to be identical. The dash 2s appear to be identical to what you first saw as dash 3, and the dash 4 appear to be identical to what you first saw as dash 3.
Okay. So your testimony would be as to the dash 3 and dash 4 now?
Yes.
Okay. Of the official. Are both satisfied? Are both parties at this point satisfied?
Yes, Chairman Butler, we are.
Thank you very much. Gil?
And Mr. Chair, make one short statement for the record, if it please.
You bet.
I just wanted to note that county government, being very close to the people, has no interest in arbitrary bureaucratic red tape, so they fully support these two amendments.
Thank you very much. We appreciate that clarification. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, this bill is ready to move.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
You know, they've been the subject of some harassment on some of those early morning meetings, too. So, good to see they maintain their senses of humor, Gil. I appreciate that. And thank you very much. Representative Berger actually... is who breathed some life back into this particular bill. by scheduling one of those early morning appointments as well. Else, I think the parties were at a standoff at that point. So I appreciate, Representative Berger, your bringing this forward.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that you did appreciate it at some point in here because you have worked very hard on this bill, and I appreciate your efforts.
I thought it was really important to you, or else I
You put a Herculean effort into this, and I'm appreciative.
Okay, colleagues, we have the Dash 3 and Dash 4 amendments. We are on work session. Representative Berger.
I would like to move, Mr. Chair, the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2659.
You've heard the motion, colleagues, to move the Dash 3 and to House Bill 2659. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to moving the Dash 3? Hearing and seeing none, and recognize that full complement of the committee. So ordered, Dash 4, Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2659.
Representative Berger moves the Dash 4 amendments into House Bill 2659. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2659 as amended to the floor with a detached recommendation.
You've heard the motion. For the any discussion? Further discussion? Colleagues, this is a very this is a long drawn out compromise, but it is truly a compromise. I appreciate the folks who have come to the table, the folks from the Metro Multifamily Housing Association and the Association of Oregon Counties to make this work and to try and see if we can't clear up the logjam of the issues that are blocking up in the courts relative to this valuation of and appeals on multiple family housing. With that, the motion is to move House Bill 2659 with a Dash 3 and Dash 4 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Any objection to that motion? Hearing and seeing no objection, recognizing all members present, so ordered. Representative Berger, it was you and Representative McPherson who brought this forward. Would you like to carry that?
I'd be happy to, unless you wanted to do it, Mr. Chair, because certainly no one is more... no one's worked it harder than you have, and I appreciate that. I'll be happy to carry it if you would like.
Why don't we go ahead and have you carry it, if you would, please,
not a problem.
And unless you wanted to share it with... I noticed Representative Hass's name on it, too, but Representative McPherson had sent me a note to see if we couldn't get it back resurrected, at which time I said, that bill is not going to see the light of day unless we get everybody together on it.
Okay.
So if you'll carry it, I would appreciate it. With that, we will close the work session on 2659. Thank you, Mary. Paul? We'll open a work session on 3460.
Mr. Chair, I just have a couple of things for the committee on House Bill 3460. This is really the nature of an update as to kind of where we are on this. The first thing is there was discussion about the school revenue forecast committee that was created by executive order in 1999. And the committee had requested a copy of the report in which that's in your packet there, dated December 1 to Superintendent Castillo. And it outlines the cost factors that were assumed in the governor's budget. And the assumptions behind ADMW growth and local revenue and so forth. So you'll have that in your packet. Those numbers will be updated shortly for you for your legislatively approved budget that will hopefully be soon. The next thing I want to do is just kind of, we've had some discussions. The chair had met some of the earlier participants in the work group that you got the report from. And what I've tried to do is lay out for you under potential amendments kind of the discussion and some of the things that are being worked on. And really, I think the intent now is to start to get some direction from the committee as to a sense in where we should go on these. The first and most critically important is the percent of the income tax that's dedicated to schools. And as you recall, in the original bill, it's a 50% dedication. That is somewhat lower than the historical average over recent years, but it's also, of course, important to recognize income tax is a highly elastic tax in the long term, and you discussed that. But initially, certainly that percentage is probably the key policy choice. Also, the biennial growth rate you discussed, there's an 8% biennial growth rate in the bill. We've looked at a 9% as an alternative in some of the discussions, and so that would be a key parameter as well as to what's the allowable growth going into the state school fund. Of course, the higher the allowable biennial growth rate, then the less you have available to put into the other two funds, the stabilization fund and the successful schools fund. Another thing that we had talked about is a legislative review, a specific time. For example, you could say 2011, the legislature shall review this biennial growth rate and observe the following factors, costs, for example, overall inflation rates, student enrollment growth, those kinds of issues could be built into the statute as a specified date in which the number will be reviewed.
Paul, do we have other look-back statutes right now that direct for a look-back on these kinds of things? Any of at present? The reason that I ask that isn't to play stump the chump. I apologize. It's to see if we can't use the language. That's what we call our radio program. It's me on it back home when I'm on it back home. Stump the chump. The reason that I say that is that look back language. I wonder how strongly you have that worded. If you don't come to some conclusion, does the whole statute go away? Mm-hmm. If you can't come to some conclusion, do some parts of it go away? What does that look like? Have we ever done that?
I can't think of anything specifically. Of course, the strongest way to force a look back, we often do, and that's a sunset. And so if you have a specified sunset date, then obviously the legislature has to review it and take some action. So that would be the strongest step to take. The language is something we haven't looked at specifically, but that would be obvious a choice issue for the committee. We have talked about the successful schools fund and its purpose, and that there is, you know, if we do have stronger growth than anticipated, our income tax revenue generates, even if it generates it's a trend amount, we will get fairly rapid growth in this fund, assuming our economy performs as it has historically. So it may make some sense to put a cap on that, and we've talked a little bit about 2%, 2.5% of the state school fund. So, and then once that would happen, you'd make the choice about what happens to the revenue that would be going there. Well, one thing would be just to divert that back into the state school fund. So the state school fund would have another revenue source going in. The bill has a one-half division for the revenue between the 50% and the 8% growth. There's, of course, nothing magic about one-half, one-half. We looked at, again, with successful schools fund, perhaps a one-third there and a two-third on the stability fund, which, of course, would grow the stability fund more rapidly and would raise some issues down at the bottom. So that's another key decision choice to make in the bill. The starting date, talked a lot about the starting point, and, of course, we'll have a forecast release tomorrow. And that may have some influence on that decision in terms of 0305. But in terms of 0709, what I have done in the assumptions is just take 8% or whatever that biennial growth rate is from the budgeted amount for this biennium, for the coming biennium. So, and that doesn't have to necessarily be that way. So, but that's the way those spreadsheets have been set up. The successful schools funds allocation and uses, there's been some discussion about that in terms of you had a fairly lengthy discussion about that and successful versus low performing schools and what the intent is, and there may need to be some amendments there in terms of that language. The last two items have to do with the Education Stability Fund. Remember that the Education Stability Fund is constitutional, and it creates a sub-account once you get to 5% of the previous biennium general fund revenue. So at 5%, you're looking at a little over $500 million now. And so that, if we do have a fairly strong economy, this would be an additional revenue source that could fill that fund up pretty quickly, easily by 2010, 2011. If that's the case, then money will start flowing into the sub-account. The uses of the sub-account are not defined at all. So that would be something that would need to be defined, and you can define capital and basically what we call soft capital if you'd like to have it much more flexible than we have, for example, under property tax law. So that would be an issue. The other issue would be, the last one there, would be a decision whether you simply want to use the revenue to flow into the stability fund up to 5% and then divert it back into the state school fund or some other purpose. So it doesn't have to flow into that capital sub-account. Remember that the stability fund is a constitutional fund, and once money goes in there, it has to follow those guidelines. But the revenue source is statutory. So you can cut off that revenue stream if you want. It's unlike the 18% lottery where you'd have to have a constitutional amendment to change that.
Okay. Colleagues, the folks are still staking out the territory amongst the parties on House Bill 3460. Wanted to make sure that we had this update available to you. Questions of staff? Representative Berger is recognized.
Before I lose the thought that he just left us with, okay, Paul, what we originally envisioned was this Educational Stability Fund be a kind of a Part B. Mm-hmm. And what I think I just heard you say was that even if we kept Part B at 5%, the Part A would still flow, and so it still would go into the capital matching sub-account.
Yes, that's correct. I've talked with council about that, and that's their understanding as well.
So if we cut off Part B, the only way we could cut it off was to then say when Part B reaches, or the whole thing reaches, I'm trying to visualize how this would work, then the Part B would go back into the current operating or some other, would you be diverted? Is that what you're proposing?
Yeah, yes. What I'm proposing is that you could set some trigger as to when the revenue stream stops. So it could be some limit on what the Part B is. It could be a limit on the total fund.
But Part B would stop, but Part A would continue to go,
yes.
and it would fill the school capital matching sub-account.
Yes, once you got to 5%, both the revenue sources would be flowing into the school capital matching sub-account.
You could shut the tap off one.
Yes.
Okay, got it.
And under Constitutional Measure 19, falls at 18% at that point and drops down to 15%.
That's correct.
Overall.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And that does that continue to build the Education Stabilization Fund even after it hits the 5%?
It does, Mr. Chair, because the overall fund it does, but it starts to build the sub-account, which
right.
is within the
okay.
fund.
Okay. Which is the amount then in excess of 5% of the
yes.
general fund.
Right. Mr. Chair, I did ask John Marshall and Chuck Bennett to look over these and to make comments for the committee on some of the work that they've done.
Okay. Gentlemen, are you prepared to respond to the request of legislative revenue?
Mr. Chairman, Chuck Bennett, Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Yes, we have had an opportunity to go over these and probably have some answers on a number of them of numbers that we'd fill in the blanks with. We'd be glad to go through and discuss those numbers or just go through kind of a way that we arrived at some numbers that we think begin to achieve some goals. Mr. Chairman, the issue here that we heard during testimony on the bill and in going over it, number one, as we said during the initial testimony, this is a really good opportunity to work with a platform that gives us a chance over the next number of years to both stabilize and create a predictable school fund, but as we listen to the testimony, and I think it's one that we hear also from our members as they take a look at a variety of runs or discussions that go on around this, is that you have to take on the question of adequacy to some extent. We certainly are not talking about a quality education model level of adequacy through this kind of program. That's going to require substantial restructuring of the tax system, and that's not what this is about. This is about how do we stabilize school funding. This is how I've understood it from the speaker and listening to the testimony. How do we create a predictable funding system that allows school managers, school employees, communities, children to be guaranteed they're going to get from year to year a funding level that results in an adequate or more than adequate education? What we don't want to have happen is that this becomes a stabilized, inadequate funding level. And with that in mind, we began looking at a way to push these numbers forward. And in looking at the historic growth of, or the historic share of K-12 has received from the personal income tax, we found it was at around 55%. But in the discussion and in the testimony that went on, I think the information from Paul was that we're seeing an increasing share of the personal income tax going into the state general fund. And with that in mind, and the growth that's anticipated in the personal income tax, we came up with a figure of around 53% would be a particularly reasonable number and would begin to show a kind of growth in K-12 funding that would allow us to, over the next 6 to 8 years, begin to grow our way out of this, out of the situation we found ourselves in the past two biennia. We looked again at the 12% growth in the personal income tax, which is sort of the ceiling we were up against, and felt that a 9% growth rate and then dividing the remaining 3% between the a 9% growth rate in the state school fund and dividing the remainder between the successful schools fund and the Education Stability Fund in some formula would we believe again put the money where it's needed, which is into the schools directly into the existing basic program that we offer. We looked at the numbers again and found that one of the concerns that came up during testimony and one that I think just can't be answered is what does the future of the state's economy look like over the next several years? Mm-hmm. So we concluded, I think, in thinking about this and talking with others about it, that the real stake for us in the two additional funds that receive a portion of this 12% growth rate was the Education Stability Fund to guarantee that we didn't, if we had a dip in the economy, we would not see the same kind of impact on the basic program that's offered. So we were proposing the idea somewhere around two-thirds, one-third between the two funds. And then also
two-thirds
into the stability, I'm sorry. Yes,
successful, or one-third into the successful, two-thirds into stabilization.
That's correct.
Okay.
And then looking at the successful schools fund and what the successful school funds, as we understand it at this point, and this may change as this is fleshed out further, but that the successful school funds really is a targeted program onto schools with very particular long-term or chronic problems, or those that have some very successful programs that we want to either encourage or replicate throughout the system, but that really has a kind of ceiling on it, and we felt that the amount should be about 2% of the state school fund, and then the remainder left over would go back into the state school fund. Any additional funds would go back into the state school fund. the outcome of numbers like this, Mr. Chairman, are the kind of numbers that would, I think, be very attractive to school districts around the state, would be the kind of commitment to education at the K-12 level that indicate we're not interested in seeing shorter school years, fewer teachers, larger classrooms, tattered textbooks. I mean, you can go right down the list of the kind of bad things we hear about. It doesn't mean, though, that we're going to be offering a quality education level model. It's a good, solid, basic education. It allows us to begin to get back middle school athletics, some of the music programs, lost teachers, and it also offers the opportunity to deal with some of the issues that we know we're going to face in the next couple of years. We really know that within 2 years we're going to have a substantial jump in our at least $200 to $300 million hit next biennium in PERS rates alone. And this allows for those kinds, we believe, would allow for those kinds of impacts and allow us to continue the program without, it appears, without having to come back to the legislature and hopefully remind you this is a floor and that we need more money. And we're back into the how many hundred million on top of this will we need. We think this starts to create a really basic and stable, as well as achieving real meaningful levels of adequacy. So those are the kind of things that we came up with in specific terms when we really got a close look at it.
Thank you, Chair. John, did you need to add something to that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. John Marshall representing the Oregon School Board Association. I think Chuck has laid out some of the ideas that we've looked at. I think one piece that he didn't mention, though, is the school capital matching account. And I know that you all have discussed the issue of growth, rapid growth school districts and their unique challenges. We've talked about some rural school districts that are having difficulty keeping their buildings in a state of reasonable repair. And we believe that there are possibilities to significantly increase the amount in that capital matching account within the next couple years that can make a significant difference for all kinds of school districts with capital needs. I mean, that pot starts to grow to the extent that we believe we can significantly help both those school districts that can't seem to build school buildings fast enough and those that just don't have the community wealth to be able to afford fixing the and repairing the buildings they currently have. In conclusion, Mr. Chair, thank you for convening the work group, to those folks that sat on the work group. Thanks to Paul for his patience in looking at the numbers. And we believe that within the next several days, hopefully, the chief sponsor of this measure will agree with us that we have some good ideas and are able to take the platform, as Chuck suggested, that she's proposed and build on it and make it even better. And we look forward to bringing back to you, hopefully next week, some specific amendments to accomplish the end that we're all looking for. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. Questions for these folks, Representative Hass?
Thank you. This may seem like it's way out of left field, but since the premise of this bill is based on income taxes or percentage, and because we have we lose so much money into tax credits and tax expenditures, do you think it would be appropriate to have some kind of an amendment that dealt with that? In other words, one that either, say, repealed specific tax expenditures or put sunsets on some or limited so that there would be no more and couldn't, have the opposite effect of stability? Do you see a way that kind of approach could be worked into this with the goal of strengthening this stabilization process?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Haas, the problem, I think, with trying to amend this bill with what you're describing would be that we would be substantially going beyond, I think, the scope of this bill. But I think you have to agree that a bill like this in place is going to have is certainly going to have a more direct effect in future legislatures as folks take a look at the variety of revenue change options you described and their impact on K-12. They do now. And what I would worry about is that we would also... I don't follow these as closely as you do, but I'm going to assume that some of the tax changes we're talking about are based on assumptions or analyses that have determined that with these tax changes there will be increased income taxes. And so I don't know that this is the place you would change that discussion. I'm just not sure this is the right place for it.
I think that within the bill you could perhaps limit any further changes, because if you're going to establish a percentage rate that is dedicated to schools, then I think that and you're talking about personal income taxes at that point, then you perhaps could limit any further changes to the tax code without adjustments to that percentage of dedication. And I'm not sure how that would look, but that would probably be within the scope of the rating clause.
I tend to agree. I think that that's sort of this animal that's been getting away from us here, and we keep focusing on this end of the box, and the back door has been open for a long time on the other end.
That would certainly demonstrate good faith attempt to say, well, if it's growing at... If personal income is projected at this particular rate, but the next legislative session decides that it's going to give another tax break, when they offer that additional tax break, if it's with regard to income taxes, if it's not revenue neutral with regard to the tax break, in other words, there actually is a net cost to that tax and becomes a tax expenditure for the individual income taxes that would be affected under this personal income tax model, then that may well be provide a formula to come back in and say the percentage now goes to 50, add 1% to whatever it is, or if you've got a change in the tax code that says interest is no longer no further depreciation beyond straight line, then you look at that and say that the effect of our connection, our reconnect with federal at that point, have to, if the percentage is 53, then you got to drop it down to 52 as a result of that, or 51.5, or whatever the fiscal is. So that, I think that's probably within, and I think that would demonstrate good faith on the part of the bill itself. It's not an attempt to defund education at the expense of personal income tax breaks either. Representative Galizio?
I think my question comes from Centerfield. Actually, two questions. One is, do you any idea that, let's say in the last decade, the inflationary costs annual for schools, in other words, health care, textbooks, fuel, wondering what that is. And then secondly, why personal income tax? I mean, we just passed through, on this side, a rather large capital gains tax cut. And so why not a percentage of the general fund? I mean, why the personal income tax as kind of the fulcrum?
Representative Galizio, I think there are two issues that we talked about in the work group. One is a definition of general fund. And what's in, what's out, and I think the best examples used were when the Medicaid upper payment limit funds have been used in the past to support general fund programs, that the master tax settlement agreement, and those funds have been used to support general fund programs. So the issue, I think, is one of definition. What is the general fund? And the other, and there was quite a bit of discussion, I think, in this committee as well as the work group about the elasticity of the personal income tax, and it's the most elastic source of revenue we have, and it's certainly the largest. In fact, it's becoming, as I think has been pointed out, a larger share of the state general fund. In terms of the overall inflationary cost increases in schools, because school district expenditures are primarily based on a salary, I think if you look at least salary growth over the past, it's been relatively close to the consumer price index. And as we know, over the last several years, the rate of inflation has been relatively low. What we are seeing are, and obviously, the cost of medical insurance, for example, is exceeding the rate of inflation. Our PERS rates are exceeding the rate of inflation, and certainly fuel for our school buses are exceeding the rate is exceeding the rate of inflation. So I would guess that probably overall, if you sort of averaged all those together over the last decade, we're probably looking at the rate of inflation maybe plus a point or two. I'm certain that probably some folks at the Department of Education have looked at that and looked at those costs. But in terms of the future, I think what we're primarily concerned with at this point are the costs associated with the public employees retirement system and the employer contribution rates that we know starting on July 1 are going to increase 53%.
If I could ask that,
please, Paul.
Representative Galizio, there is the assumptions from the school forecast committee in the back of your,
in terms of
what the assumptions were going forward in terms of costs, in terms of overall teacher salary, health benefits, and PERS.
Appreciate that.
But that's the forecast part and not the history.
Okay. Can I
follow up, Representative Galizio?
I love being surrounded by people that have a crystal ball, and I'd love to talk stocks after the about what's going to happen in the future. So that's exciting.
Don't talk to me. I bought Enron.
All right.
Not once, not twice, but three times.
Yeah, that's right.
All the way down.
Yeah.
Chased it to the bottom.
So, but in terms of the general fund, couldn't we sort of explicitly define the general fund for purpose of this calculation?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative Galizio, I think by attaching specifically to the personal income tax, we've all but done that. That really is where we are at this point. At today at 90% at an increasing value, you can extrapolate from that a percentage of the general fund just based on the 90% factor, and you can determine how this would relate to the general fund in that way. What we're trying to do, I think, if I've understood, is attach school funding to what appears to be the best particular available revenue resource we've got, which is the personal income tax. And I think that what you're asking for would be an interesting exercise, but I think we've done it. I think it's here.
The responsive referee?
Okay. Theoretically.
Thank you, Paul, for... yes, Representative Kamp.
I just have a question for Paul, because believe it or not, since January 10th, I've been trying to get my arms around this.
Oh, yeah, I'll bet.
Yeah. And I pulled out my book recently, the QEM model, and I just had a question of the calculations. Do all of our calculations... Do they parallel each other? Are we using the weighted numbers, or are we using actual student numbers? I mean, the QEM model, it doesn't say whether they're using... It drives me nuts. It absolutely drives me nuts, because nowhere have we ever talked about our actual children in our schools.
Okay.
And that number is appreciably different by 100-some-odd thousand than what we deal with of actual and real children. And it just, I can't make sense of the numbers because they don't seem real.
Okay. Representative Kopp, you know, I know we do see different definitions, and I'm sure you see it in different areas. We do have Brian Reeder here from the Department of Ed. He's probably most familiar with the quality ed model. And I'd like him to address that, Mr. Chair.
Brian, would you like to come up, please?
Thank you. I just can't quite make sense of all the dollars until I know how we're starting out.
Welcome, Brian.
Thank you, Chair Butler, members of the committee. For the record, Brian Reeder from the Department of Education. I'm not sure I have a specific question to answer yet.
The question I have, Brian, is if we take the number of the essential school budget level of 5,318, in order to build what you think is the essential budget level, would we take that figure times approximately 550,000 students, which are what are currently in our schools, or would it, we take it times the $660,000, that would be the weighted number?
Chair Butler, Representative Comp, the essential budget level number, the 5,200 and something,
right,
is expressed on a per weighted student. So if you
were
going to blow that up to the state level, you would multiply it by the roughly 650,000 students.
Okay, now I think I just heard you say it. Now I'm confused again. It, you would multiply it, because I first understood you to say you could multiply it by the real number, 550, but if it's, if it includes the weightedness, that's what you'd multiply. But you said then you'd multiply it by the 660,000.
Chair Butler, Representative Comp, I apologize for not being clear.
That's all right. It's probably me.
The number you mentioned from the essential budget level is a amount per student, which is roughly $5,200.
Right. It's 5,030. $3,300. I'm sorry.
That number is a per weighted student number. So if you want to get to a state-level funding need, you would,
right,
multiply that by the number of weighted students in the state,
okay,
which would be 650-some thousand.
Okay, so that still confuses me, but I accept your definition of that.
I think that the letter of December 1st, 2004, which is attached from...
Right, that's what prompted this again.
Okay. And that's the ADM, and she shows $659,407 weighted students at 5,303.
Well, Mr. Chair, that's the weighted students, and it is important to recognize that the growth trends between the two are different. The weighted,
exactly,
weighted students are growing more rapidly.
Right, because we continue to
have new rates.
Classifications. Right. Yeah.
Well,
the amount of students that are in those classifications appreciably are growing.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Further questions?
No, that was what I was trying to figure out. You know.
Further questions
what
from Mr. Reeder? Thank you, Ron. Further questions of staff? We'll bring this. My hope is to bring it back at least one more time. I appreciate the information that OEA has provided, Lori Wimmer, and I'm in the process of trying to digest that, too. Did you get a copy of that? Can I get a copy of that down to you? Okay. All right. Okay, please, if you would, Lori, get copies of that. Thank you. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 3460. We'll open a public hearing on House Memorial 7. Liz Bell?
Chairman Butler and committee members, with House Memorial 7, this is dealing with estate taxes, in particular the federal estate tax. So it expresses support by the Oregon House of Representatives to Congress and the President of the United States to permanently abolish the federal estate tax. It acknowledges the hardships that businesses face paying the tax, as well as the hardships families suffer if businesses have to close and employees lose their jobs in order to pay for the federal estate tax. It provides that copies of this memorial shall be sent to the President of the United States and to each member of the Oregon Congressional Delegation. So we've talked a lot about estate taxes, and I just gave you some background, but the important point to just recognize that under current law, in 2001, with that Federal Economic Growth and Tax Relief and Reconciliation Act, it eliminates the federal estate tax effective 2010, but just for 1 year, and then under current federal law, beginning tax year 2011 and beyond, the estate tax would be reinstated on all estates with gross estate value above $1 million. So this is basically trying to address that issue. and asking for this federal estate tax to be abolished. And just so the last paragraph here, the staff measure summary tells you how much Oregonians have paid in federal estate tax. So in fiscal year 2004, Oregonians paid $245 million in federal estate tax, which represents roughly 1% of the total U.S. federal estate tax collected of $24 billion. And in 2004, the federal estate tax collections for the federal government comprised 1.1% of the total federal tax collections. So this basically, even so everyone's clear too of our connection again, we are not automatically connected to any federal changes in the estate tax area. Okay, so even if this... if the federal government decided to abolish the estate tax in the future, Oregon would not be connected to it without further legislation. So basically, this is something that we have our own standalone Oregon estate tax now.
Thank you. Questions, Elizabeth?
I'd like to ask Jody Weiser and Michael Dowdy to come up first.
You're looking alone, Jody.
Jody Weiser with Coalition to Preserve the Estate Tax and Tax Fairness, Oregon. Michael had to leave. He had a meeting with some other people. I'm surprised I'm here talking to you about this issue again. This is an issue that we are taking care of the wealthiest 1% with your time one more time. These are people who won the birth lottery. They and yet we know that massive accumulations of wealth actually hurts our economy. It kills opportunity, and it's the anathema of the ideals of equal opportunity upon which this country was founded. Now, there's a lot of research out there that makes repeal of the estate tax look very populist. You know, it looks like everybody wants this. And that's because that research is done by asking one question or two questions. And the questions are always standalone. Do you think this is a fair tax? What do you think of the death tax? And people say, I hate it. But actually, that's a statement about right now everybody's hating every tax. If, in fact, you... if we just got rid of all taxes, what it would mean eventually is that we would have no army. And then we wouldn't be paying taxes to the U.S. government. We'd be paying taxes to whatever government army conquered us. So obviously we do need taxes. It's just a question of whether this is the tax we're going to have. When they have polled people about whether they should get rid of this tax in comparison to other taxes, what happens is that people say we should cut the estate tax about 4% of the time. It's generally the least popular tax to be cut, corporate taxes being sometimes even lower. 4% in one study said advocated cutting the estate tax, whereas 7% said cut capital gains tax, and 34% said reduce taxes for moderate income and middle income people, lower income people. Even more people thought you should reduce taxes across the board. In other words, your constituents, if you ask them in a whole which group of taxes should be cut, this is not the one they would be talking to you about. Rates instead last amongst their interests. So really, this is about basic fairness versus unfairness, because we do need taxes. There was a survey that came out today. It was done by requested by Robert Frank, who's an economist with the Johnson School of Management at Cornell University. And he asked the Survey Research Institute of Cornell to do two surveys. Mirrors of each other in a way. One asks the typical kind of question, do you favor or oppose repeal of the estate tax? And 3-1 people wanted repeal of the estate tax. Then they asked a set of questions that reminded people of the deficit, of fact, for instance, that you would have a hard time funding things like getting doctors to go to rural areas if you didn't have tax money to hand out. or raising other taxes. And the shift was dramatic. 4-1, they said don't repeal the estate tax when compared to the other costs. So really, the estate tax is a surcharge that kicks in only if we're lucky enough to be one of life's biggest winners. And frankly, I think it's a moral outrage that this committee struggles over issues of serving real needs, over whether there should be a minimum cost of living increase for minimum wage earners who will pay taxes on those minimum wages, and then consider giving rich inheritors all of the leftover fruits, not of their labors, but of their parents' labor, without any taxation at all. And that's what this motion calls for today. I love to stop coming up here to talk about the estate tax. Thank you.
Questions? Any questions of Jody? Thank you, Jody. I have a panel here, Don Schellenberg, Stuart Olson, and Don Sursofsky. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau, and with me today on my immediate right, Stuart Olson, who is a member of our Farm Bureau Labor Advisory Committee, and Don Sursofsky, who is a member of our Tax Advisory Committee here today. I'd like them to go ahead and make comments first, and then I'll draw some conclusions, except to begin by saying that we are here in support of HM7. Go ahead, Don.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for considering this memorial to Congress for the permanent repeal of the estate tax. And thank you for your time in allowing me to speak to this issue. It is time to kill this tax on both the federal and state level. The estate tax is the most unfair, regressive, and unethical tax ever conceived. And those are its good points.
Before you get to his bad points, you want to put your name on the record for us.
Don Sursofsky.
Thank you.
A person works his entire life to better his socioeconomic standard, to make a better life for himself and his family. He hopes to be in a position to leave his heirs in a better financial position than from which he began. This is the basis of the American dream. If he should happen to succeed, the state and or the federal government come along with an exorbitant tax which shatters that dream and makes that next generation start all over again. The former 55% rate shared by state and federal governments took away any incentive to create wealth. Citizens spent thousands of dollars on attorney and tax accountants to try to shield themselves from estate taxes. When they thought they had an estate plan that would help them, either Congress or the state legislature would change the rules, making it necessary to spend thousands more on attorneys and accountants. On the farm, this cycle has ended in farm families losing their farms. This happened to a family whose farm I rented. Even though the family thought they had a good estate plan, they found themselves with an estate tax balance that was so high that they had no choice but to sell the farm to pay the taxes. The assets were there, but the cash was not. To make this case even more somber, this farm was less than a decade away from being named one of Oregon's Century Farms. This particular case is a glaring one, but there are others that are more subtle. They go unnoticed. These are the ones in which the farms are mortgaged in order to pay the estate tax. Quite often it is 10 or so years later that the farm is lost. Nobody but the family knows how it happened. The added cost of servicing that mortgage to pay the estate tax finally takes its toll on the farm operation, and the economic feasibility of the farm collapses. A farm that was once bought and paid for is, in effect, lost to the government. Is it fair that each generation should have to buy back the farm from the government? This is one reason why more families have not achieved that special recognition as an Oregon Century Farm. The family farm in Oregon has survived this long only on its ability to increase production. Oregon farmers have learned how to grow more on fewer and fewer acres. For example, 30 years ago, the average yield for annual ryegrass in the Willamette Valley was less than 1,600 pounds per acre. Today, that average is close to 2,000 pounds per acre. Unfortunately for us, the price of our products has not kept up with inflation. 30 years ago, the price of annual ryegrass was about 18 cents a pound. Today, it's 21 cents a pound. The cost of raising that pound of ryegrass has doubled in that same amount of time. The price of wheat is even more astounding. In 1976, a bushel of wheat sold for more than $6. This year, the price of wheat in Portland peaked at $4.04 a bushel. I do not believe that we can continue to increase our production enough to keep ahead of inflation. Requiring every generation of farmers in Oregon to buy back their farms to the government will destroy far more farms than it will save. Please be fair. Please promote the family farm. And please end the regressive, unfair, and unethical estate tax once and for all. And please ask Congress to do the same. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kuchelski. So nice that you're here. Any questions? I think why don't we hear the whole panel and then answer questions.
Okay. Yeah, my name is Stuart Olson, and I'm from Salem, Oregon. And I'm a small family farm east of Salem here, and I have two sons that farm with me. And right now we're in a situation where we're going through with two attorneys and an accountant to try to figure out what we want to do with our estate. And it's been an eye-opener for us, and it's taken a lot of detail. And my two sons want to continue farming. If something happened to me today, I went down the road and got killed, they would probably be in a situation where they would possibly have to pay estate tax, and I don't think that they could afford to do that. We would probably have to sell some of our ground off. Then if they had to sell some of that ground off, they would be looking at a situation they would be in capital gains possibly in that area, so they'd be another tax on top of another tax. So I guess we're kind of this, we'd like to see a permanent estate tax in effect, because 2010 is not very far off, and I think it's a situation that small agriculture needs something like that. And that's what we are. We're a small family farm. We are a corporation. Makes us sound like a big operation, but we're not really. So it's an important issue for us. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Don Schellenberg, Oregon Farm Bureau again. If you want some of the best peaches, they're just out the road here at Mr. Stewart's place. I have two pieces of comment there. One of the Oregon Farm Bureau, which I will not go over. I would like to call your attention to the one titled Oregon Meal Westfall. And this recounts the problems that the Westfalls had down in southern Oregon, down a little town called Bridge down there, where they have a timber operation, and it was left to them by their great aunt. But the long and short of this was they had a $640,000 estate tax bill that they had to pay in order to inherit that property. One of the interesting things and the disappointing things is when they came out and assessed the property to see what the value was, the government did. Timber was selling at $340 a board per thousand board feet. And when they went to pay the tax, the timber market took a drop, and they were harvesting timber then at $160 per thousand board feet. So the impact just doubled on them because of the swing in the market. In addition to that, they had to exceed their sustainable harvest management plan in order to make those payments. So you got really a double negative in this particular case. Following that, they embarked on, as Mr. Olson did, a plan to figure out how they could move their property to the next generation, and that cost them another $200,000 to get that in place. So all in all, they've spent over $750,000 just to keep the family operation in business and in the ownership of the family. This ought not to be, and so we're here today to support HAM 7, a sense of the Oregon legislature, the House of Representatives to Congress, that they need to do the permanent repeal of the federal estate tax. And we'd ask you to move this bill to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you very much, John. Questions for this panel?
I just had a comment.
Yes, sir.
I would say, Mr. Olson, you need to get new attorneys because they don't know what they're talking about. They should be able to figure this out. It's not that complicated. Secondly, if they're talking about capital gains, if you have the misfortune of passing away, I don't really understand where capital gains come in for the transfer tax and the estate tax.
Chairman, Representative, what is it? Delisio. Yeah. Well, yeah, it is a situation where I have a father that is 92 years old, and if he passes away, we bought the ground for like $400 or $500 an acre, so there would be some capital gains on that situation, and so we're in a situation. The two attorneys, the reason we're using two attorneys is the fact that one of them is going through our corporation type stuff. We're getting everything in order on that area. And the other area is she's an estate, a tax planner. And so there's so many things that are coming about on this situation. There's so many new things. I mean, every year there's something new that comes about. And so they're advising us every 3 to 5 years to update this. And so that's where the confusing part is. If we have just a permanent estate tax went into effect, then we wouldn't have to worry about it. I wouldn't have to spend my time going in with my attorneys and going through with the accountant and this type of stuff. So Mr. Neil Westfall went through, and they on his farming operation there, their timber, they had to go out and sell some of their timber and this type of stuff to pay for this tax. And that's a tremendous amount of money to come out of. There's no way that can come out of a lot of farming operations with that kind of tax. And that's, we're trying to keep these small family farms in existence out here. And believe me, it's tough right now. And I don't think that you guys would want to see small family farms go away. That's not our intention, or anyone's intention. But sometimes those things come about where it does happen. So thank you.
Let me just confirm for the record. I think under federal law right now, in 2011, we go back to the
$1 million.
Yeah, but it's back to the $1 million. But there's an additional problem at that point, and that is there is no step-up in basis at that point.
Then you'd pay the capital gains.
Yeah, you'd have to pay the capital gains tax at that point. Plus, from what I understood of the testimony by listening to it as I went down the other end of the building and back, I think Oregon, after the first death in Oregon, the step-up in basis is only as to one half of it. And you don't get a full step-up in basis. So it's frequent that the survivor of the two people passing away, the survivor, that survivor's interest will only have a step-up in basis as to one portion of the value. And finally, as I understood your testimony, you're in a small family corporation, too.
Mm-hmm.
And that creates additional issues. And the reason that we have to have, and Representative Galizio, it's kind of important because last session, I recognize you weren't here, but last session, one of the things that we did was the legislature is an attempt to get out of the building and fund everybody that wanted to be funded, including an additional $500 million for education, which we didn't have, passed a bill to increase the corporate minimum taxes. And the agriculture community is kind of a double whammy there. First of all, as the testimony indicates, you can't control the amount of money that you get off your crop. You're pretty much at the market, mercy of the market. But the other side of that is that what happens when you tax a farm corporation based upon gross receipts, and that's what they were doing, was they were taxing farm corporations on gross receipts. It's not uncommon to have a farm corporation that will have $3.5 or $4 million of gross receipts and have just $20,000 or $30,000 worth of net income, just enough to supply the family with their needs for that particular year. So, I do have in my accounting practice background and experience with people that are selling between $3 and $5 million worth of production per year in their agriculture operations that are in effect only yielding enough income for just one or two or three families, and that's a very modest income. That's less than $30,000 per family is what it is for full-time work for the parents and the family members in these farming operations. So the minimum tax on corporations that we passed ultimately last session, that minimum tax on family farm corporations hit the farm corporations harder than it hits. Actually, the tax was after Enron. They were after Enron is who they were after, and they ended up hitting our farm corporations. And finally, family farms have had to incorporate because you can't subdivide the land anymore. And so you have to stick the land inside the corporation in order to divide the land up amongst the family members, because you can't give 20 acres to this child and 20 acres to that child, or even 40 acres or 60 acres, or in Eastern Oregon, 320, I think, John, is the minimum lot size in Eastern Oregon at this particular point. And in some cases, it gets worse than that. They want to determine how much productivity there has been historically off of it. So typically, you can't divide up the farm amongst your family anymore. So what we've done is, in order to get around the land use planning issues and still be able to give pass the farm to the family, to the next generation, or attempt to, we've had to incorporate, and that process, as I say, has been doubly difficult for those folks who are in the farming businesses. So
the minimum corporate tax hasn't been changed since 1931.
But it was in last session.
But it was overturned.
That's what I say.
So
it was the farm community that backed that, and believe me, you get 1,000 farmers that are upset, and they'll get another 1,000 per farmer that are upset about trying to double and triple tax a small farm operation like that. So, yes, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sympathetic to your plight. I grew up on a small family farm myself, half of which was peach orchard, and the other half was just general farm. We raised everything just to keep our family fed, if you will. So this problem has been around for a long, long time. And what confuses me, and let me tell you also that the last several years my occupation has been as a business consultant trying to solve problems for businesses. And what confuses me about this problem is the fact that the only piece of the problem that we ever hear is about farms, small farms. And I don't understand why we don't solve the problem for small farms instead of trying to repeal a tax which affects lots of other folks, since farms is the only thing that seems to be the problem. And that's where I have a real problem with this. I really want to save your farm, because I wanted to save our farm.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see us attacking the problem correctly. We're not attacking the problem of saving farms. We're attacking an entirely different problem, which maybe includes that, if you see what I mean. And so that's my problem with what we're doing here today, and I wonder if you could address that. Anybody?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, one thing that I look at is nobody's ever taken into account inflation. In 1950, there were millionaires, and they had lots of money. Today, there are billionaires, and about the same number as there were millionaires in 1950. $1 million exclusion on a farm is ridiculous. My banker told me I was worth $1.2 million. I said, could I have it, please? I'm struggling to pay my health insurance, which I don't get any extra benefit from. I can't get a group policy. You know, trying to put my kids through school. You know, put food on the table. And a $1.2 million farm doesn't do it.
So what if we made a $10 million exemption for farms?
I don't think that's enough, because I am a small farmer, and my neighbors who are two and three times as larger than I am, and I have to admit, my farm is so small that my brother and I are having trouble making it.
What if we exempt farms?
Can you get Congress to do that?
And that's probably outside the scope.
I can get just as much help from Congress to do that as I can from the passing the resolution we're looking at, because they don't care what we pass.
Thank you. Further questions? Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, they don't need to stand in the chair for me to say that I would sure commend you to Olson's peaches.
I think there'll probably be some in here later.
I've had a few. I know where his farm is.
You can't really put the pressure on me.
I don't know where your farm is, but I'd like
what's come up for tour?
I'll come down and see you.
I'm just up 5 miles up the road. And that's one of the things we're in a situation, too, is that we're so close to subdivision and stuff like that, it makes it tough to figure out where your estate is. I mean, you'd think that they're going to appraise it at this price, and all of a sudden, boom, you get this tremendous appraisal out there, and you go, where did they get that from? I mean, you think it's not worth much, but all of a sudden it is.
I understand.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Jason Williams? You bet. Great. Yeah, Wayne Brady. It's great testimony. Thank you very much, Mr. Olson. Appreciate it. Who wants to lead off? Jason or Wayne?
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Williams, Executive Director of the Taxpayer Association of Oregon. Thank you so much for having me here today. I got two handouts. We're here in support of this bill. We're the people that helped bring it forward. I want to say that this is one of those things that passed with good bipartisan support there, and now we just want to make it permanent. 68% of the public, Americans, think that this tax should be repealed. And I know you can play around with polls, but if you ask people about should the money rather go to Amtrak subsidies or some of that government pork that we hear about, like funding the Cowgirl Museum, I'm sure people would rather choose to repeal the death tax. There's a handout talking about economists. There's 278 economists who are calling for the repeal of the death tax. As explained earlier, this tax does carry a big compliance bureaucracy cost to it. But also, I mean, fundamentally, just the tax, we see it as wrong. Death is not a time to be taxing people. The passing of an inheritance to a family is a very sacred, intimate event, kind of a rite of passage. And when you watch a family going through a difficult time when someone's about ready to die, and they're scrambling to shelter what their mother or father spent their entire lives building up, it just kind of ruins that family experience. And when, of course, it happens all over again when that person dies. And it's even worse if there is a family business involved. And we just feel like it's not the government's business to get involved with such inheritances. A death is not a taxable event. The government needs to be out of that business. And finally, it has strong business support. 75 national business organizations support this, including the NFIB, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the National Black Chamber of Commerce, the U.S. Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, and the National Association of Women Business Owners. So it has wide support, and we just feel it's just time to put an end to this, put to death the death tax. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman,
My name is Wayne Brady, and I feel, as Jason does, that this is it really defeats the desires of parents to help their children have a better life. And I think as a practical matter, the breakup of small businesses of all kinds, not just farms, is destructive to the economy and creates a loss of jobs. And I think if in the long run, the government might actually come out ahead and because of income taxes and so on, that they would receive if those businesses were left intact. Oregon, state of Oregon, for instance, only gets 0.9% of its revenue from inheritance tax. It's very small. And, you know, the kind of limits they're talking about, you know, $1 million or $2 or $3 million in today's world, it's not, doesn't represent much of a business. So I think it's an unfair tax, and it also probably is counterproductive in terms of government revenue and the economy in general.
Thank you very much, Wayne. Questions of these two carriers, or these two committee, let's call them panel. These two panelists. Thank you very much. One comment that I would have, that I'm anxious about the discussion, the exchange that took place relative to farms. I am anxious about what the federal is doing right now relative to 2010. I mean, we chuckled about that back in 2001, 2002, that it wasn't, you know, we'd never get near that without something happening. And as we draw closer to 2010, there's nothing happening. So my concern is that in 2011, what happens is we do a rollback, but what's worse than the rollback? And frankly, I don't know what's going to happen with regard to the state income tax issue or death tax issues at that point either. I'll probably have already paid my share of them and been gone by then. But my concern is this, that if we move in the estate tax arena to 2011 and go back to a $1 million exemption and no step up in basis, then I can tell you that that is truly the Accountant's Full Employment Act. Because I have records in my basement back in my office in Ontario that become worth an absolute mint because they track basis like we used to have to do on a number of things. And my concern is that if we don't do something at the federal level, that we're going to have an absolute mess. And then you talk about capital gains, that particular point, and then maybe that's the best solution, is to do nothing, and then the federal government just sits back in its easy chair and says, let those capital gains come rolling in, because you're going to have virtually, it'll be an overnight windfall of billions and billions of dollars to the federal government, and if we stay connected, it'll probably be a windfall of billions and billions of dollars in the long term to the state. So I think we just found the solution to our funding problem.
I think it would be a short-term benefit. All the destruction resulting from that, I think.
The destruction would be immense.
Yeah.
The destruction would be immense. But you see, you have that, Wayne, going on in Oregon today with no step-up in basis in the second half of an estate during after the first death. It's not uncommon for... I wish I could tell you that I could count it on one hand the times that I've done this, but it's not uncommon after the husband's death, and that's why we used to track the basis in these farms and ranches and so forth, was we would track that basis because after the farmer husband's death, the widow would come forward and in order to pay all of the expenses and pay off the farm loans and those kinds of things, have to sell the farm and only have a step-up in basis in half of the farm and the antiquated basis in the remaining half of the farm, so that there's a very significant capital gains that's taxable right there. That's fine. But then the widow then uses that money to pay off all of that and usually ends up just about a break-even. Only one time do I remember that they ended up with more than $50,000. I think it was $65,000 the widow ended up with. And unfortunately, she moved into a rest home where the people found her checkbook and and stole it from her, and it was an absolute shame. She ended up destitute.
Well, it'll probably make for interesting CPA advice for people to please die within the next 3 or 4 years. You know,
let's see, die in 2010, I think, is the advice I've been giving my clients. Yeah. Die in 2010.
I think that's the advice you gave yourself.
Well, yeah, I will have been pushing up daisies, I think, by then. Particularly after this session, so I've been aging in dog years during legislative session. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I fully agree that the 2011 is going to be a problem, and dropping back down to that low minimum is going to be a problem without some basic change. But that's not what this resolution talks about. This resolution talks about a full repeal, which is an entirely different situation.
Yep. Okay. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. With that, colleagues, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Memorial 7. And, colleagues, remember tomorrow is forecast. Tomorrow at what time, Paul?
It's at 8:30.
8:30 here in this room. We will be guests of the Senate Revenue Committee. And colleagues, they're also going to have members of the House Ways and Means.
We'll have three House Ways and Means members.
Okay.
And I will be in a different committee.
I beg your pardon?
I will be in a different committee.
Okay. So his chair you can give up to three other people, then. Okay. Representative Boquist.
Mr. Chair, just for members, passed out earlier to you a copy of a list of cities impacted by 2787. If you've got comments, please kind of get back to me.
Yeah, the lightning rod goes up at Representative Boquist's office, folks, on these. Thank you very much for taking that heat.
And just so for the record, I don't know the answer. Those are the total affected positions or whatever, but I don't know whether it's revenue-based or whether it's geographic-based, and I'll get that information. So if you have questions, or company, I'll track down whether it's revenue-based or whether it's geographic-based.
Okay. Thank you very much. Colleagues, until tomorrow morning, and Representative Riley, have a good weekend. Thank you. With that, we'll close House Committee on Revenue.